Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Don't sweat the technique.
You listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
Texter from The Hive, the illegal motion by Mixon was so egregious. He's been playing football for a long time, and that's always a penalty. Even if the OC is dumb enough to call that, he has to stay put. Highly doubt that motion was practiced, and if it was, fire everyone on that side of the ball. There's no way that Bobby Slowick's calling a play where multiple guys are in motion.
That's
an illegal shift. It is an automatic penalty. It's plain as day. There's no way that's on Slowick. It was either Joe Mixon like went in motion and shifted at the same time as Tank Dell, or it's what C.J. Stroud said. And C.J. Stroud said in his postgame that he said something wrong, and that's why Mixon shifted. I tend to believe it was Stroud.
I do, too.
Frankly.
I absolutely do. That's why I brought it up. I just feel like, look, there's times that you're right. They're gonna fall on the sword and take the bullet so that no one else gets blamed. And that's cool. That's being a great teammate and all that stuff. But in this case, I really believe that however it happened, you know, miscalling of the play or whatever – I would put it on CJ and believe him at this in this particular instance. And the crazy thing, Jeremy, was that penalty didn't come out right away. Like, they didn't realize until they said the flag came out late. When they realized that that play was going to result in a touchdown that could be a game changer.
I thought I saw it right away.
Go back and look at it. I saw it. I could be wrong, but I saw it live, and then I rewound it this morning. It seemed to me like they said, you know, looked like motion. They didn't call it. And then the Nico play happens. They're like, the flag comes out late. And then it was, you know, the two guys in motion.
I mean, that was so obvious.
It was. I think that's why, too. It was a blatant and it was going to result in a big time touchdown. With time, I think they had to call it. And
I think you might have been fooled by the graphic.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think the graphic might have went up late.
I think the announcers notated early
on. No, I see a flag right here. I just pulled it up. You can see the flag land right as C.J. Stroud's throwing the football.
Okay.
Yeah, he's throwing it. The top official throws the flag, and I'd be curious to see if the bottom official did too. Maybe not, because it was on the top official
side of the
field. You
would think that should go up before he even – way before he starts
– Well, no, it's not a penalty until it's snapped, because you can have multiple guys shifting at the same time. They just both have to come set for a second. I think he throws it as soon as it was snapped. He just kind of throws it high in the air so everybody could see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Regardless, you're right. I put it on CJ. I think that, you know, I really believe he was owning up to it at that point because he also realizes how impactful it was and how hurtful it was to the team's chances to win the football game. You just can't have those things happen. I don't. At this point, it's almost, it's relevant. I want to know why it happened.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't happen.
I think it's CJ too, but that's why I was kind of like, I don't care whose fault it was. Like, this is the Houston Texans problem. Whether it's Stroud, whether it's Mixon, it doesn't matter. That's Pee Wee level football. If I had to assign blame, I do think it was on Stroud, but at the same time, that cannot happen no matter whose fault it was if you want to be a team that actually has aspirations of being a deep playoff team. And I don't think anybody has those aspirations anymore. I think they ruined those aspirations from even the most homer of fans, quite frankly. D'Amico Ryans was taking some heat yesterday. And look, I have a theory that whenever the fan base is mad at the coach, it doesn't matter what they say. They could say that they're donating $1 billion to like the city to help clean it up. And they'd be like, well, it should have been $2 billion. Like as soon as the fan base starts to turn sour on you or they're mad at you, it does not matter what you say. And D'Amico Ryans had a quote after the game where he said the offense scored enough points to win today and the defense needs to be better. It's catching a lot of heat. People were thinking that this could have some, you know, send shockwaves to the locker room, like crazy thoughts based on this. So I thought it was very important to pull the entire question so we can get the entire context of what was asked and then what the answer was. So here's the Q&A, D'Amico Ryans, much maligned, saying that the offense scored enough points to win yesterday.
You guys lost some last 2-1-score games. Is there a growing concern right now that you guys just need more from your offense?
The concern for me is we need to play complementary football, right? We play complementary football, we win games. When we don't, we're not relying on one side, right, to carry the entire team. So whatever happens, like our offense gave us enough points to win the game. So that starts with the defense. We didn't do enough to stop them. We didn't stop the run, and we didn't run the ball well. And we gave up way too many points on defense. So our offense did plenty. They gave us enough points. In defense, we have to be able to stop them.
Should D'Amico Ryans be taking heat for this answer in the postgame yesterday?
I mean, I don't think so. I think it's one of those situations where because he's such a prideful, he'll take the heat for it kind of guy. I don't think that you're going to have a locker room that any guys that know D'Amico at all that think that they're getting crapped on as a defensive unit to take the bullet for the offense. I think that his basic premise is probably going to be we shouldn't have given up the big long ball right after we took the lead. We shouldn't have given up the big plays that we gave up all game long. Sure, it was our defensive front putting up great numbers and sacks and doing all the things that they were doing, but it's more so the fact that he's responsible for the defense and the fact that as good as they were on the front seven part of it, that they had a ton of shortcomings on their side of the ball too. I know everybody is out for blood and they're looking for whatever they can pounce on. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to make too big of a deal out of a coach that really knows it was a tough loss and is trying to he'd love to move on, but you just can't without addressing what failed and how miserable the outcome was.
I think it's completely ridiculous to bash D'Amico Ryans for the answer to that question. There's a lot of things that happened in the game, and we just went through them 15 minutes ago, that you can point to D'Amico Ryans and poorly coached football team, and these are the signs of a poorly coached football team. If you want to punt on 4th-and-1 at your own 39, I'm not going to stand in your way. I'm not going to be critical of you of that. But when you take a delay of game to make that decision, that's borderline ridiculous. But the whole Q&A yesterday, it's crazy to me that people are diving this deep into this and using this as a D'Amico Ryans bash, like flame session. He was asked about the offense's struggles. He's not going to throw them under the bus publicly. Like, that's who D'Amico Ryans is. He might be honest that we need to do better at this, A, Y, and Z, A, B, and C, X, Y, and Z, but he's not going to sit there and be like, okay, this is the issues. Bobby Slowik stinks. Stroud's got to be better. Joe Mixon needs to run the ball better. The offensive line, they got dominated by the defensive line. He might say those in roundabout ways, but not those directive terms. So this was just him not throwing the offense under the bus and him being the defensive play caller saying, well, look, we got to clean up our areas too. We can't be all on the offense whenever we had some areas of concern as well. So, and we always talk about fan base, like they need a coach who shows responsibility and takes responsibility for their errors. This was D'Amico taking responsibility for a defense he didn't think played all that well yesterday. So there's a lot of reasons to bash D'Amico Ryans today. This one is silly.
I completely agree. I just think that, again, everybody's got the crosshairs on every single possible person that could be responsible for what they feel like is a devastating and embarrassing loss. But at the end of the day, it's not like we don't think that the defense did their job. We know that the defense was dominant, destructive, was putting up the sack numbers that, you know, was the sacks in the first half alone was just ridiculous. The fact that we're going to sit there and point the finger and say, yeah, this is definitely on the defense. We know where the shortcomings were. We know where they lost the game. We know why we lost the game. But if you're expecting him to come out and just drink some truth serum and go, guys, sit down because this is going to be a long one, but I'm just going to have to, you know, call it like I see it and call out the guys that didn't do it. It's never going to happen.
Yeah, I disagree with the Texans defense being dominant and destructive yesterday.
No, I said their front seven.
I mean, can you call the front seven dominant and destructive whenever you give up 130 yards on the ground?
Okay, interior offensive line, interior defensive line, you're right.
I mean, they got, I think one area they were dominant. I mean, sacking the quarterback 8 times is dominant, but I don't know if the overall product was dominant. You can't give up 132 yards and say that any part of your defense was dominant. The pass rush might have been dominant.
Okay, the pass rush was dominant. The pass rush was definitely dominant, and the pass rush was keeping you in the game because the pass rush was doing everything to get you the football back to prevent them from getting into scoring position and getting drives that were ending in points. You're right. Pollard can't be a guy that's gashing you, and you can't let, you know, Levis is going to get his occasionally because he can run the football, and if they call it, a lot of times the defense is, you know, got so many other things to worry about that he can get away with it.
I mean, he had 10 yards. I mean, he was
I'm just saying, overall, if you're game planning. But for the long haul, yeah, Pollard was way too effective, but more so, you have to own the fact that you couldn't run, to his first part of his comment, you couldn't run the football, and you couldn't stop the run. Yes.
Yeah. See, I think the defense was bad yesterday. Like, I don't agree that the defense was, like, good. Was the defense better than the offense yesterday? Sure. But that's kind of a pillow fight comparing the two. The defense, you get, look at the yards they
look,
gave up.
Until
they gave up 369 yards. They gave up how many yards on the ground? 132 yards. You're giving up huge play after huge play.
That's the
after
problem.
Huge play. They had two explosive touchdowns. The defense was bad yesterday.
A tight end blowing the top off the defense and sprinting by almost your entire defense after you finally took the lead was the one that kicked you in the groin that basically settled the score in a lot of ways to say that just can't happen and your defense can't do that.
Yeah.
But I think to that point, because of how bad the offense was and because they were kicking themselves in the foot, no matter every chance they got to take points off the board, that the sacks were stopping drives almost all by themselves in a lot of ways, especially in the first half.
And they did give up 32 points.
Like, right, but in the first half, it was, what, 20-17 because of his turnover. But you gave up 17 points. You could have given up a lot more if not for the fact that the sack.
You gave up 20. I mean, they had 20. Like, okay, I see what you're saying. You gave up three because of the late.
Right.
That's still
right.
A lot of points.
Yeah.
17 points to the Titans is a lot of points. It's a lot of points.
Yeah. Well,
that's to me where D'Amico's coming from. I think like was the defense better than the offense yesterday? Sure, like I'll concede that. Sure, but they were nowhere close to their standard, and they were nowhere close to good. So D'Amico Ryans isn't going to sit there and point the finger at the offense when his own defense was bad. Like he's not going to do that. He's gonna be like, well, look, we were not good as well. So like we have to clean up our own issues too before I'm sitting there pointing fingers. It's not like they give up 3 points and lost a 3-0 game. It's not like Will Levis threw for 120 yards. He threw for 278. It's not like Tony Pollard went for 24 carries and 50 yards. He went for 119. It's not like they got nothing over the top. They scored two explosive touchdowns. Like the defense was also bad. Was it better than the poor offense? Sure. But it was bad defensively too.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that overall, it's just the fact that we can sit there and dissect the internal, you know, area by area, offense, defense, special teams, and position by position. The fact is, overall, this was a inexcusable performance. And this was, to your point, embarrassing. This was something that was not supposed to happen, no time in the season, to a team that is as bad as Tennessee's supposed to be. But when you look at it, you say, you can point to four different reasons or five different areas to say why they lost this football game.
No doubt.
And that's where the biggest issue is. A team that's supposed to be considered a playoff team, they're going to be a playoff team. And a team that's supposed to have the aspirations of getting further than they did a year ago are not supposed to have four and five different reasons why you lost the football game and more questions than answers, especially at this point in the season.
Mm-hmm. 713. But I think that's where D'Amico's coming from there, though.
Right.
Like, the offense was bad. You're willing to throw the offense under the bus. He's like, look, we got to look at the mirror of what we did defensively. That was also a bad product that we put on film.
As a coach, though, too, Jeremy, the other thing is, and that's kind of, I think, what we're saying without saying it completely, but as a coach, you're in for the long haul. So you do to yourself no good to air out in the media what you should be fixing behind closed doors.
I completely agree. And that's why I don't really take press conferences that serious, because they're not very, very seldom are they giving you the actual truth.
Right.
Very, very seldom. And they're going to usually keep that stuff in-house, especially D'Amico. D'Amico's pretty dang guarded.
He is.
There's some coaches who are more transparent. There's certain players that are more transparent. D'Amico Ryans gives you almost nothing. All right, 713-780-ESPN. I believe. What do you believe after this college football weekend? 713-780-3776. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
The winners, the losers, and all the best college football moments this weekend.
Ward by Antonio. Hit from behind. The ball pops up. Georgia Tech's got it.
Did you see it?
Pressure. Back goes down. The ball's out again. And it's Rebels football.
Can you feel it? Do you believe now?
You believe that? You hold on. Hold on. Oh, no. Do you believe that?
With the Killer Bees.
What do you believe now after this college football weekend? 713-780-ESPN, HRP listener line, 713-780-3776. Blankers, what are you believing?
I believe that as much as I thought that Ohio State was going to blow the doors off of Indiana and that Indiana might be exposed, the fact that we had so many upsets has just put a gaping hole in how big the opening is for Indiana to be one of the final 12 teams. When you look at Colorado, Alabama, BYU, A&M, Ole Miss, all losing, the fact is that not only did Indiana benefit, but you looked at it and go, this whole thing's a crapshoot for the most part.
Yeah. I think it's a crapshoot on the bubble. I don't think it's a crapshoot necessarily.
Even the top teams don't look dominant. I mean, we're talking about Georgia one loss away from possibly – you know, sliding out, and now they're going to be in the driver's seat to get in the SEC championship game. But overall, even the top teams have aside from Oregon, and they have blemishes. We don't see these powerhouses like the dominant that we've seen in the past.
No, I think I'm with you. I don't think that there's a major dominant team. And remember, we were talking last week that I think whenever we get 10 years of information on the 12-team playoff, assuming they stay at 12 teams for 10 years, I think we'll look back at this season as having a pretty soft bubble. I don't think the bubble is always going to be this soft. So I'm with you on that. But at the top, it actually leads perfectly into my first, I believe. I think there are only four teams that could win it all. Because I do feel like, yes, not a perfect team, but I still feel like it is top heavy. I think there are only four teams in the nation that can win the national title. I think it's Oregon, Ohio State, and Texas and Georgia. I think two teams from the Big Ten, two teams from the SEC, Oregon, Ohio State, Texas, Georgia. The most pushback I've gotten with that take is Tennessee. And I will concede that Tennessee's probably my fifth team if I had to power rank chances to win the national championship. I'm not willing to include them in that top four, though. But those are my four teams that could win it all.
I think that that's probably the top tier. I think Tennessee just has too many inconsistencies when they're supposed to come out big, when they're supposed to get the production out of you know receivers and their offense, when their offense from week to week is supposed to be so effective. I just think you're right. There's a line drawn in the sand. Those are probably the four teams that can win it all. There were teams that early on impressed me. There were teams that late started to impress. Like South Carolina is an impressive team, but they're not even going to get in because they kind of handled their own destiny early on. Tennessee was a hot team early and then kind of showed you who they were. They're too inconsistent. Alabama, after what they did to Georgia, you're like, damn, that's a hell of a football team. And then they proceeded to show you that they don't belong. So the two teams in the Big Ten, their schedule alone, they don't really, aside from playing each other, and that was a hell of a football game, the rest of the Big Ten is so much lesser than. And from a cream rising to the top perspective in the SEC, those are the clear-cut two best teams.
Yeah, see, I think Alabama's loss or win against Georgia was actually kind of fluky. I feel like if you go back and watch that game, you're like, well, which one of these two teams is the better football team? I think that Georgia was the better football team. They just had, like, every break go against them. What else do you believe, Blankers?
I believe that the fact that Ohio State blew out Indiana didn't have nearly the meaning that I thought it was going to mean because of the fact that your punter had a ball slip through his hands. Then you gave up a punt return for a touchdown. The score looked like it was more dominant than it was. But at the end of the day, I expected more from Ohio State than I saw. And because of that, I'm not as high on Ohio State as I was because I actually thought that if you played on a neutral field, Ohio State would beat Oregon and could be one of those teams that could compete with whoever comes out of the SEC. And I came out a little less than when it comes to Ohio State after that game on Saturday.
They won by 23.
But Jeremy, you gave up 14 points with special teams. I mean, the fact is that Indiana's offensive line got exposed, but that's Indiana. When I see them playing and try to envision them playing against one of those three other teams that you mentioned, I just don't see them being a dominant football team.
All right. Good thing with the playoff that it'll all play
sure.
out. I thought that late touchdown wasn't great for Indiana, but then, like you said, with all the losses, it didn't really cost them a whole lot. I believe that the gimmicky two-point conversion overtime is really, really bad. I'm not a huge fan of college overtime to begin with. I think it's very gimmicky. I don't like gimmicky OT periods. All of a sudden, you're going to play football and the possession arrow or the possession game, the field position game, and then suddenly here you go. Here's the ball at the 25. Go score. But then what makes it especially bad is once you go to that third overtime, now everything's just a 2-point conversion. That isn't real football. And look, regular season, who cares? It's just a regular season game. What if there's a playoff game that's ended that way? What if it's the national championship game? What if somebody loses the national championship game because of this stupid, gimmicky third overtime? You got to go for two. Not even go for two. It's just a 2-point conversion. I hate it. It's stupid. If you need to keep it in the regular season because you don't want games to go seven overtimes, okay, I can kind of understand that. But once you get into the postseason, they should flip the overtime rule like the NFL does. Get rid of this stupid 2-point conversion OT that starts in the third overtime and just play it out. Play it out, baby.
I honestly think that the best overtime is the NFL playoff format for overtime, where both teams are going to get the chance to possess the football. You know, if it's a field goal and then a touchdown, you lose. But other than that, it's as fair as you can get, because I'm with you. I mean, for those that stayed up and saw that ending to what turned out to be a hell of an exciting football game to watch, just going for 2-point conversion sucks. It's awful. And even from the to the point you're making, if you score and you want to go and just kick the extra point and take your chances yet again, go for it. I mean, let them do that. But forcing them into all these different things instead of just letting the best team win by moving the football, scoring points, doing what they want to do, and then playing defense, I can't stand it.
If a playoff game ends that way,
oh man,
I'd be livid. Now, the game ended like at 10:30, 11. What do you mean stay up to watch the end?
Oh, I heard a lot of people said, oh, I went to bed after, right towards the end. I'm like, I don't know how you do that, just simply because of the fact that it was so close and down the stretch. Like, that was so exciting. Yeah, I didn't really have a dog in the fight. So what? It was an exciting football game.
Are these your friends that go to bed at 9?
No, I mean, none of the – I don't have friends.
It was a weekend. It was a weekend at like 10:30,
11. It was a later finish. It was like, I think, at least 11-something when the game ended, wasn't it?
You got a game going to triple overtime. It's a great game, and they're going to bed.
Hey, man, I just report what I hear, okay? I'm not saying it was me. I'm saying there were people out there that were shutting it off early. Abigail said she was done after 3 quarters. Just couldn't
stand
it.
Yeah, I was done.
See? She was done. There you go. And she's a youngin'.
Abigail's a casual.
Yeah, went to bed by 9 p.m.
See? There you go.
Yeah, but you get up and work out in the mornings, don't you?
How do you know that?
He spies on you.
Because you've told us that you're training to do your first ever
competition.
Bodybuilding.
Oh, yeah, I am.
Oh, yeah, you forgot
that. I'm a great listener. I listen. Kenny Dillingham is a bona fide psychopath, and I love every bit of it. I love every bit of the fact that Kenny Dillingham is a bona fide psychopath. That's the way college coaches should be. He's sitting there dropping Rounders quotes in his postgame, paid the man his money. He's yelling at referees and everyone whenever he's in the wrong, when he's standing next to students. That guy is awesome. He's
talking about that finish with Arizona State?
Collective. Yeah.
Well, that was nuts. And the fact is that the one thing that I think people kind of lose sight of in the whole thing, that the Hail Mary was completed. If they penalize the home team, regardless, then he's got the arm strength to get that thing in the end zone, and we might be talking about a different outcome.
Huh. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point.
That's the first thing that I thought of, was like, hey, wait a minute now. It took like 10, 15 minutes to clear the field, and that should be on the home team, and that should be a 15-yard penalty. You give them 15 yards, that ball's in the end zone.
Yeah. I don't know if they should get penalized for that, though. That's a bad penalty. They thought the game was over. Like, they're not doing anything like malicious. That'd be a bad penalty. That'd be criminal. Lamont says he believes that with 3 losses, that Bama will still be in the playoffs. It's gonna be interesting what the committee does.
Yep.
With all the losses that happened this past week. Now, what's interesting about A&M is they still control their own destiny. I mean, they beat Texas. They're in the SEC championship game. You win the SEC championship game, not only are you in the playoffs, but you're getting a bye.
That's right.
In the first round. 0511, I believe that the portal has ruined college football. See, I disagree. I disagree that it's ruined college football. I think that it's actually created more parity to college football. It certainly changed the landscape, but I still love college football.
I love college football, but you definitely have drawn the haves and the have-nots, and it's more clear-cut, because the combination of the NIL money and the fact that it's basically free agency in college football has basically come to the point of whoever's got the biggest, backing with the most money in their account and the deepest pockets have a clear-cut advantage. You can buy whatever you
need.
I don't know
if the gap is greater. Like, if was the gap 5 years ago whenever Alabama was just killing everybody greater than it is now? Like, you just talked about how the top is
I think there's more teams
perfect.
At the top. But the money has changed so much to the point where, you know, Matt Rhule says you need over $2 million to get a five-star quarterback, and then that was completely rewritten by the whole fiasco with LSU and Michigan. Now you need $10.5 million to go get a guy.
I don't know how that changes the gap, though. Like, was the gap between the number one team in the country and the number 10 team in the country greater 10 years ago than it currently is? I feel the divide has actually gotten closer.
I think there is more parity this particular season. But I think overall, as time goes on, I think that the deep pockets are going to be the ones that win out.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess we do need more time to get a pretty good, like, you know, pool of information. That's a fair point. 713-780-ESPN, go ahead.
I got one that you're going to love, though, for the other, I believe. I believe that you and I both know better than most that you have to have
Who's
good...
you and I?
You
University
and I. You,
Iowa?
Jeremy, and me, Joel. We know better than most. You need good rim protection. And if you're going to go on the road and bring your own hoop and you want to dunk on the opponent, you, one, have to win the football game. And, two, you can't give up possession of said hoop and have their logo put on your backboard and then your walk of shame as your equipment guy is trying to walk it out of the stadium. Ole Miss brought their hoop to the sideline at Florida and were trying to dunk on the Gators. By the end of the game, the Gators had their logo on the backboard and had the Ole Miss equipment guys doing the walk of shame with it off the field. You can't have that. Thanks, Jeremy. Where's Jeremy? I understand like a 5 second pause if he decided that he wasn't going with me on that one.
I don't know. He's getting up and walking around.
Okay, so maybe we've got issues. Which I already knew I had. You want to go to break?
Yeah, you got my bookie.
All right, we're going to go to break, and we're going to hopefully get Jeremy back on the line for the second half of the show. We got one half in the books and one half still to go. We're going to come back with a whole lot more, but before that, I do want to remind you of the fact that Thanksgiving weekend means there is a ton of games and a lot of games to bet. When you don't want to hang out with the family, but you want to put money down on some sports because you got a chance to actually come out a big winner, then I tell you to go to mybookie.ag. And Thursday, because it's Thanksgiving, means there's a ton of sports that you can cash in on, because mybookie.ag is the place you need to be when you put down on money. Thursday, they have that whole forgiveness bet, and it's perfect on the day of thanks. You should be giving thanks for that. Because, like, if you think A-Chain's going to be the first guy to score for the Dolphins against the Packers on Thanksgiving night, you can bet on it. If it doesn't come to fruition, you can forget about it. But if it does, you can cash in. That's the way they do the Thursday boost at mybookie.ag. There is a variety of different ways they take care of you and tons of different ways that you can cash in. All you got to do is go to mybookie.ag right now and sign up. If you're signing up for the first time, there's a sign-up bonus. Whatever you put in, they'll put in up to $1,000. More money in your account, more games you can bet on, and more chances you can win right there. And then also, they have live dealers standing by, even when there's not games going on. If you want to get your casino fix on, play some poker, play some blackjack, don't have to fly to Vegas or drive to Louisiana, right there on your tablet or in the comfort of your own home on your phone, you can do it with mybookie.ag. But you always got to remember our promo code. That's how you cash in and get those deals. It's bet975. Anytime and every time they ask you for the code, you give them bet975, and you are in business. Even with their rewards program, MyBookie Plus, get involved, sign up. They're going to register you, and then with every bet you place, you have a chance to climb up the tiers to cash in even more. They take care of you all the time because they love and appreciate you as customers, because you know that your money is safe and secure, and they're going to take care of you every step of the way. As I always tell people to do, you can bet on anything, anytime, anywhere, with the only place I tell you to do it. It's mybookie.ag, and our promo code is bet975.
Mail call!
It's a Mailbag Monday with the Killer Bees.
You've got mail.
Blankers?
Hello?
Can you hear me, Blankers?
Now I can, yes.
There we go.
You could have just told me you didn't like my take on Don't Get Dunked.
I didn't hear it. I was actually, what was it? I was actually intrigued. I was on the edge of my seat.
Have you seen this whole, Ole Miss was traveling their own basketball hoop, and every time anybody made a play, they got to dunk. And not only did they crap the bet against Florida, but Florida somehow got their logo on the backboard.
Yeah.
And we're dunking on it. And then the walk of shame was the equipment guys for Ole Miss had to escort their basket back to the bus and the plane with the Florida logo on it. They didn't even get it off.
I did see that. That was funny. I like a good little college troll. I like a good little troll, period. Some people call me a troll. I don't know where they get that from, though.
Me
I don't
either.
Really see it myself. 713-780-ESPN. What is your question for the Bees? 713-780-3776. First question's about the Fred VanVleet ejection. What did you make of that? Should he have been suspended?
It's not a good look for a guy that's supposed to be the guy that's supposed to be the veteran leader of this team that's setting the example. But at the end of the day, if they suspended him, I understand. If they don't, to me, it's not that big. He hasn't been playing that well. It means more playing time for the other young guys that I'm fine with, too. So I'm fine with it either way.
I thought he made contact with the official. Clearly not, because the NBA came out today, or actually it was Ime Udoka who came out today. He said that Fred VanVleet will not be suspended, so he must not have made contact with the official. The video that I saw, I thought he poked him in the nose.
Yeah, it was close. But at the same point, that might be just frustration coming out on Fred's part, because he has been less than for the majority of the season. He had that one game where he was like 10 for 11 from the floor. Other than that, he has been not good more than he's been the guy he's supposed to be for 40-some
million
dollars.
Sure, but I mean, talking specifically about the ejection.
Play. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that he had made contact with the nose, but I mean, if you're not getting suspended, they must have looked at every single camera angle and realized that, nope, he didn't.
Now, I hope Ime's right, because normally I would wait until I heard from the league, because of course your coach
sure
is concerned.
Did.
Yeah, you hope so.
I don't think Ime would say that he's not going to be suspended if he hadn't heard from the league.
You're and probably was, right, but I've also
worked. He was
also
fined. Like, they announced a fine, too.
Yeah, if the league announces the fine, then they would also announce the ejection at that point. You're right about that.
Yeah.
I've worked with coaches, by the way, that thought if they got out ahead of it, that the league didn't want the bad look, and they might lean your way, but yeah.
Which coaches were that? Because that's a bad take.
I'm not calling them out at this point, but more than one.
That's boring.
I'll tell you that.
Come
more
on.
Than one.
Don't be soft.
More than
don't
one.
Be soft. Call them out.
Nope.
What's your question for the B? 713-780-ESPN. Last week I asked if the Texans defense is just good against bad quarterbacks. This week I'm asking if the Texans defense is good, period.
I think their pass rush is above average. I think their pass rush is very good. I think when healthy, their interior defensive line can be very good. I'm beginning to question their secondary more, including their best corner. Stingley has been the best of the bunch, but overall, the last couple games have told you that you need to have some concern about the secondary too.
Yeah, I like their defense. I do think that their defense is good. I think that their pass rush is elite, quite mm-hmm. frankly. Now, there are areas that you could get to this defense, and I think it's in the middle of the field. I think that you can run up the middle against this defense. I think that you can attack the Texans over the middle in the passing game. And yesterday was over the top a little bit, too. I think the Texans took Titans a little bit lightly. I think they took Will Levis a little bit lightly. Another texter, Mailbag Monday, 713-780-3776. What's it going to take for the Texans to be an elite NFL team?
I think consistency. I think the fact that they have to be able to score in the second half of football games. I think the fact that it all starts with the offensive line. I think in order to be a team that can be considered elite, because of what we just told you about the defense, which can be better than average, even with some holes that they have to work on. The fact is that when you have a quarterback that basically has an internal clock where the alarm is going haywire every time he receives the ball from center, because the fact he's expecting to get hit, that affects your pass game, your run game. Everything that happens on offense is predicated by an offensive line that has been completely and utterly atrocious compared to what it was supposed to be. So I think that, for starters, I'd say your offensive line has to be a lot better.
I also have a take as well. I think that they say things and do another. So I feel like they need to fully put action into their words. Like the postgame shows, they're telling oh, I need to work on this, but there's nothing to involve that. We haven't seen that.
What if they're just incapable, though? Because I agree with that, and they're saying the same things over and over. But what if they're just incapable of putting the action behind the word? See, that to me is the fear.
Why don't you say that? Be honest with your fans, you know?
I think the other thing to Abigail's point is, then why are you paying all this money and investing all these assets in this offensive line if they truly are just less than?
I mean, it shouldn't be that way. That's a failure in either your assessment or
evaluation,
a failure in the production. One thing is failing to get you to that point, but I mean, you you should be spending resources in your offensive line to protect a young quarterback. So I don't fault them for spending resources in an offensive line to protect a young quarterback. But where is the mistake? Is it in the evaluation, or is it with the coaching up and the developing of the players? We all know it's a failure, but what is leading to the failure? And that's something that they're going to have to address. But, like, I could sit here and say, like, I want to be able to run a 4.440 again like I did back in my high school days. But at this point in my life, I'm just not capable of doing it.
You know what I mean? Like, that's where
so
you say.
To say it, but.
But you okay, say, okay, but Tunsil and Shaq, those are two guys that, yes, they've proven that they can do it. But you don't extend guys and give them the kind of the resources and money at a certain point if you don't realize they're on the downside or they're closer to the end than they are continuing at a certain level. And even Howard.
It's evaluation. That's evaluation for sure.
That's what I'm
saying.
How much
a player's worth. But I don't – I mean, I don't – I just have a hard time putting a whole lot of weight into what a player says. Like, I have a whole lot of I really have a whole lot of trouble putting value in what anybody has to say. Like, somebody could sit here and tell me, I have a great plan to give you $5 million. Okay, well, I don't really believe that. You know what I mean? So it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to do it, to Abigail's point. But my fear is that they're not capable of doing it. Their desire is there. Their goal is there. The mind's in the right spot. But they just can't actively do it.
See, but that's where you go, okay, I think from a talent evaluation standpoint, it completely is pointed at them by saying, well, Laremy Tunsil is considered top five. He's got to play like it. So does Howard. So does Shaq Mason.
No, the return on investment on the offensive line has been atrocious. I agree with you there. But to me, it's where is the fault? And I also think they're really bad at playing as a unit because I think Laremy Tunsil is good. I think Titus Howard's playing pretty good. Now, the interior of the offensive line is where the weakness lies, but they're just not playing terrific as a unit. I think it's scheme. I think it's protection. I think it's all of it. 1970, do you know someone that is in a cult?
not a cult. What would you say? What is Jehovah's Witnesses? That's just a...
That's just a religion.
Yeah, I think that's a religion. I don't think it's a cult.
Yeah, I don't think I know anybody in a cult, but I grew up with one of my good friends that was a Jehovah's Witness, and there was a lot of interesting conversations that were had to try and understand all of what they do and why they do it.
The only people that I know that are in a cult reside in College Station and attend Texas A&M. I'm kidding.
Oh, boy.
I'm kidding. It was a joke. Do not get after me, 12th man. It was a joke. No, I don't know anybody that's in a cult. At least I don't know that they're in a cult.
It's always a possibility, the ones you don't know.
Do you know anybody in a cult?
I mean, all my brothers go to A&M. So,
you're on Jeremy's side of this.
No, I'm not on Jeremy's side. I just didn't go to A&M because I was kind of uncomfortable. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Since we are the flagship of the Texas A&M Fighting Aggies, who are playing the Longhorns this weekend, we're going to have great guests throughout the week ahead of the big game coming up on Saturday. As you know by now, Yusei Kikuchi's gone. He's gone. 3 years, $63 million. He's going to the City of Angels. Will never experience a winning season ever again. But would you have given him the 3 years, $63 million? Did the Astros win or lose the Yusei Kikuchi trade? 713-780-3776. It's the Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to the Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
On ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
November 30th, rivalry review, Texas A&M facing off against the University of Texas at Kyle Field. Stay tuned to ESPN 97.5, 92.5 for extensive coverage of this historic game presented by Rebecca Creek Distillery. You'll hear interviews with great guests from both sides and spirited conversation from all of us. We're going to be having Andrew Monaco on 3:15 on Wednesday. Talk about the Aggie perspective, of course, the voice of the fighting Texas Aggies. Efforting Craig Way, but his show's at the same time as our show, so trying to make that work on the both parties. But also connect to our coverage on the ESPN Houston YouTube channel, social media. Enjoy Rebecca Creek Whiskey, Enchanted Rock Vodka, and Texas Ranger Whiskey to celebrate the rivalry's return. You want to say this last part, Blanker, since you don't have a Texas connection?
Nope.
Say Gig'em and Hook'em for me, please.
Gig'em and Hook'em.
There we go. Thank you for doing that. I legally cannot do that. I get fined if I do that. All right, Yusei Kikuchi, 3 years, $63 million deal to the Angels. What was your reaction when you saw that news, and would you have given them that number?
I was surprised because of the number, because of the finances, because we were talking about maybe getting 27 or more because of what he was able to do, how he put it together, and the way he finished the season. The fact that we're talking about 20, 21 a year seems to be like it was more than a reasonable price for a guy that was hyper-effective for you, that I was hoping that the Astros might have stayed in that conversation a little bit longer, regardless of what else that they do from a pitching perspective, because he was so good. Do I understand why they walked away? Yes. Do they have a surplus of starting pitching? Yes. But because that was such a significantly lesser number than what I was expecting, I was a little disappointed because of that.
Yeah. Behannon says, what are the Angels doing? I answered him. I said they're trying to win 75 games. I would not have given Kikuchi this deal, but I do find it funny that this report has come out that the Astros were interested in a reunion with Kikuchi. Well, if you were so interested, why didn't you get the deal done? Like, you must not have been that interested. You weren't interested to the tune of $63 million for 3 years. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that you were not that interested. Like, what is your level of interest? Well, it wasn't $63 million. So, like, the whole we were interested to me comes across, quite frankly, as a bluff. And I think it's insulting to the fan base, too. Oh, we were interested. Hey, trust us, guys. We were there. We were in the market. We were in the conversation. We tried to bring him home for you, the fan base, a guy that you love. We really tried on you. Say, well, did you? Because he just went to a division rival for 3 years, $63 million. So I don't think that your interest level was all that high. I think this is a whole PR stunt.
Yes.
Hey, guys, we're trying to spend money. Look at us over here. We were second place. We were the runner-up. We were the bridesmaid. Well, you must not have been willing to give 3 years, $63
million. And not only that, Jeremy, it's just the imaging. The imaging of looking like, hey, we did everything in our power to try and keep him here, but at a certain point, we just, you know, we had to pull out of the discussions, but we gave it our old college try. We kept pushing. We were in the discussions, and we've seen this happen so many times with the Astros over the years, where the fact is they want you to believe that they were in it till the bitter end, and they were making offers, and they did their best to try and bring him back, when we kind of realized a while back, like, they're not going to do that. They're probably not in the conversation. It was never really as real as everybody wants it to be made out to be, but at the end of the day, they say they tried.
Yeah, so that's where I stand on the Kikuchi thing. But I would not have given him that. With the roster that you have, I mean, Kikuchi's going to be in his mid-30s with this deal. Yes, he was really good for you, but he had not been really good in his career. He's been, like, always somebody who had high potential but kind of struggled to hit that potential. You also have a lot of starters coming back. I do think that the Astros need a starter in free agency. I think that starter will be Justin Verlander on a one-year deal with, like, you know, vesting options, maybe even a club option for the second year. But I think they need one starter, not a starter that I'm going to pay $63 million, not a starter that's going to make $21 million in a single year. So I'm okay with letting Kikuchi walk, but I just find the whole, yeah, we were interested to be a bluff, quite frankly, and I think it's insulting.
We've seen it with a lot of the big names. You may have to brace yourself that you're going to see it at least one more time before the end of free agency, because I think that to a certain degree they want Bregman back more so than the other guys. But I think that at the end of the day, if they're able to say, hey, we were in it, we were giving them our best offers over and over again, trying to do whatever it took, that they can actually think that everybody's going to be cool with it, and they can walk away comfortably going, we gave it a shot, we tried our best. It just, he got an offer we couldn't compete with.
Yeah, I kind of get the smell of that too, with the whole, like, hey, Schwab knows that the Astros gave him a 6-year deal, like, mm-hmm. 6-year contract offer. Okay, well, it seems like they're leaking out a little bit of information. Look, we're in the mix. Look, we're in the running.
We weren't going to go to six. We went to six.
Was it Heyman or the other guy that were, like, reporting that the Astros have a contract in?
Okay, yeah, well, I think it was Heyman.
Well, there you go. Why? Who told Heyman that they have a contract in? Well, it's the Astros trying to send the message that they're really trying. They're giving the old college effort. So just pay attention to that. If they don't sign Bregman, but they were in on Bregman, that's the whole Correa thing. Well, we gave Correa a contract. Yeah, but he was never accepting that contract. It's the whole Crane with Click. Oh, we offered Click a deal. Well, it was a 1-year deal that he was never accepting. So, like, they do that PR stuff. They've done it in the past. We were there on Correa. We were there on Click. No, you weren't. You never gave them a serious offer that they even balked at.
We just covered a lot of this in covering the Texans and the fact that you can use the media as a tool in so many ways, and you can put it out there when you need them. And there's also times when you're not going to give them a single thing, but when you need them, they are a tool that can be effective for you. Coaches do it when they don't like personal confrontations with their players, so they put it out in the media, and Van Gundy was the king of that. If you want to talk about, you know, manipulating the system, there's tons of owners and general managers across sports that utilize the media to get out the narrative that they want. And you can go around the ball. You can say when Anthony Rizzo was a free agent and they put out that the Astros had made an offer and they were in the running for it, it was just to make sure that the Yankees came up a step to get where he wanted to be so he could get where he wanted to be.
Yep.
Daryl Morey used to do it all the time. I mean, I've told this story before, but McHale knew the media knew he was getting fired before he got fired because the Daryl Morey thought he was doing the story breakers across basketball a favor by giving them the info ahead of time so that maybe when he needed them for something, they'd help him out too, which is never going to happen, but that's what they do.
Yeah, we know that. We know that's the case. And I feel like we're getting that a little bit here with Crane this offseason. Now, Kikuchi's gone. You traded Jake Bloss, Joey Loperfido, Willie Wagner, Billy's boy, for Yusei. Can you determine who won or lost this trade now that Kikuchi's gone?
I think a little bit more time has to pass to see just truly how these prospects turn out. I think Loperfido's the guy that everybody's going to keep the closest eye on because he was the apple of everyone's eye early in the season here, and there were thoughts that this guy could be a long-term player for your organization. But this is a chance you have to take. This is the flyer that, you know, that maybe the price was too high, but we knew the market had said that the price was going to be very high. But without Kikuchi, are you in the same position even though you got bounced in the first round of the playoffs?
I think so, yeah.
You do? I have a hard time believing it because of the fact
that... You don't think they make the playoffs without Kikuchi?
I believe that the division was turned over, was solidified when you got him and he was, what, 9-0 in his first nine starts? So I think that he played a big role in getting you the division title. But when you come up short like they did and get bounced out in the wild card round, it looks like it was a catastrophe for the Astros.
713-780-ESPN, HRP listener line. I think it's too early to tell, too. I need to see what these prospects do before I'm ready to call a winner in this. Because if they don't amount to big leaguers, then I think the Astros won the trade. But all it takes is one guy. Like, if Willie Wagner turns into a consistent, everyday infielder, now people are, like, hopping in my mentions today saying, well, he would have been the replacement at third. The Astros gave up on the idea of Willie Wagner as a third baseman.
Mm-hmm.
He might be a second baseman, but even that is pushing it. He's probably a first baseman DH, which is why he's kind of a tweener as a prospect. Like, he's not good enough defensively to play at a premium defensive position. He might not be a good enough hitter to play at a premium offensive position. So let's see how their careers go before I'm determining a winner. But Kikuchi leaving you does lessen the value that you're getting on your end of the trade.
Do you think that it's more about Wagner than it is Bloss or Loperfido?
I think Wagner has the best chance, yeah.
I think I would go Joey first.
I don't think Joey Loperfido is ever going to be able to hit big league pitching enough. I think he strikes out way too much.
Maybe so, but at the same time, he kind of got hot at the end of the year to where you're like, you know what? He's still young enough that he could pan out. And then we're sleeping on the fact that Bloss is probably never going to be a 1-2 in a rotation, but he could be a long-standing 3-4-5.
Where did Loperfido get hot? He hit under 200 in Toronto.
I thought at the end of the year he had a couple of a couple weeks together where he had several home runs and started to hit the baseball.
Let's go month of September for Loperfido. Loperfido in the month of September had his batting average overall on the year drop from .223 to .214. He didn't hit a home run in September. He had zero home runs.
Maybe it wasn't
September.
Maybe it was in late August or August. But I know that there was a stretch.
He hit two home runs in August. He hit one on August 18th. He hit one on August 23rd.
Okay, then I was wrong. I remember seeing that there were a couple games that he hit, you know, back to back or something like that. That he was hitting bombs, extra base hits. He was getting hot. But I mean, again, would you trade prospects for a
He hit 185 in September.
Jeremy, I said, okay, then maybe.
But it just took a while to load. I needed to get the information. It took forever to load.
I mean, the bigger thing to me is this is like when you go back to the whole conversation of giving up prospects for a proven talent. What, you know, there were people that wanted you to give Alex Bregman for Chris Sale that it turned out better that you didn't. But there's also plenty of times like the Verlander trade and other trades where you give up the possibilities and the potential of young prospects to get the proven player that you have that could make a difference for you that given time in that given season. At that point, I thought that, yeah, the price was too high because I thought Loprafito was the guy they weren't going to part with. But at the end of the day, if you're going to tell me the guy you got was 9-0 or whatever he was, you know, would have the success that he had down the stretch, I'll live with that.
Yeah, I want to see what the rest of the trade does before I'm ready to declare a winner. I do think that what the Astros got was way better than I ever thought they were going to get with Kikuchi. Yeah, they're calling him Joey Oprafito is what they're calling him because he's Ofer every single night. I just
Joey is going to pick it up and hit like a monster this next year.
I like Joey. We met him.
He's a good
nice
kid.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of rooting for him. But I also don't want the Astros to be, like, looking back at this trade and be like, oh, no, we screwed it up. Like, the worst thing that could happen is Loprafito turns into an all-star. So, like, I don't want that to happen. I want him to have mild success and make a good career living. But I don't want him to, like, turn into a stud. What would the Texans have done to earn the idea they could roll out of bed and beat an opponent like they did yesterday? They thought they could just show up, roll out of bed, and beat an opponent. What have they done to think they could do that? 713-780-ESPN. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.